When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Chris Holmes, and this is Burned by Books. Here you'll find interviews with writers you already love, like Jennifer Egan and Rebecca Mackay, mixed in with up-and-coming voices like Alexandra Kleeman and Rahman Alam. You'll find us wherever you listen to podcasts, but check out previous episodes at burnedbybooks.com and on Instagram and Twitter at burnedbybooks. Let's start the show. In Samantha Harvey's latest novel, Orbital, five astronauts spin through space at the edge of the Earth's atmosphere in an international space station. British, Japanese, Italian, Russian, and American, they live and work together in the low-gravity environment that is slowly atrophying their muscles, changing even their heart's ability to pump blood. In return, they are given a God's eye view of the Earth, where each day they observe every corner of the planet, its mountains and volcanoes, its oceans and seas, its city lights and desert darkness, and the weather that crawls across its blue-green surfaces. As they track a so-called super typhoon that is growing rapidly with no signs of slowing, they take stock of the meaning of their national divisions. The enforced separate toilets for the Russians, the differences in the culinary pastes and freeze-dried foods sent from their home countries on resupply ships. But the context of their claustrophobic living and the elimination of national boundaries from the Earth's spinning face challenges what seem like innate cultural differences, suggesting an earthly citizenship with more urgent demands. They see the hand of politics scrawled across the planet, revealing the devastations of human wants and desires. But they are but a handful of watchers, doomed to look at the things in need of monumental changing. A novel that is both atmospheric and deeply realist, Orbital asks us to imagine what it would mean to step hundreds of miles outside of the ever-spinning will to human progress at any costs. What communities might be found in the resolve to work for others, in dreams that value all life on the planet differently? And how might that change in perspective alter the destiny of humankind? A novel best read with Gustav Holst's The Planets in the Background, Orbital makes the glorious face of the planet a wonder to envision, and it calls upon us to reimagine the beauty of everyday being, from the smallest act of work to the grandest philosophy of moral goodness. Assuredly, my favorite book of 2024 so far, Orbital will live inside me. Samantha Harvey is the author of five novels: The Wilderness, All Is Song, Dear Thief, The Western Wind, and Orbital. She is also the author of a memoir, The Shapeless Unease. Her novels have been shortlisted for the Orange Prize for Fiction, the Guardian First Book Award, the Walter Scott Prize, and the James Tate Black Prize, and longlisted for the Man Booker Prize, among many others. She lives in Bath, England, and teaches creative writing at Bath Spa University. Welcome to Burned by Books, Samantha Harvey.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you so much for that very comprehensive and mesmerizing introduction.
Well, I absolutely adore this novel. I'm so glad I get to talk to you about it. And it's more a problem of me having far too many questions than we'll have time to address. But I'm interested, just to begin, What sent you into space for your fifth novel? Was there a particular catalyst, or had you always been interested in the experiences of astronauts living in space?
Well, I've always been interested in the experience of astronauts looking down at the Earth. So when I was much younger, you know, in my late teens, I would collect quotes from astronauts, so things that they'd said about being in orbit. This is probably preceding was predating the International Space Station, so probably, you know, the days of Mir and even going back to the Apollo moon missions and so on. But their impressions of the Earth, looking back at the Earth from space, and that was always my interest, more than being in space itself, you know, that view, that uncommon view of the Earth. And then I didn't sort of ever think I would write a novel about that. But I think at some point I started to look at the sort of images of the Earth from orbit, mainly from the ISS, on YouTube videos and so on, you know, and the NASA website has lots of images, and the International Space Station itself has a live camera, which doesn't work very often. It must be.
Oh, weird. No.
But you can, in theory, you can just sit 24 hours a day and watch it orbiting the Earth, you know, so look, see their view of the Earth as they go around it.
I didn't realize.
Yeah, I mean, and it's, all of this is just there online, and everything that NASA does is in the public domain, so you can access. I started looking at that and found myself completely consumed by the beauty, the strange beauty of that view of the Earth. And then I thought, well, words are what I have, so I wonder if I can render this in words. I wonder what words can do to this, my experience of watching the Earth in this way. The euphoria I feel, you know, I still feel that, having watched, you know, hundreds of hours of footage and looking at photographs and so on, I still feel this mixture of joy and great sadness and great connectivity with the other inhabitants of this planet. And I wanted to find a way to put that into words, and to put it into words in a way that wasn't didactic, that I wasn't really trying to talk about issues. I just wanted to paint in words of the Earth from space. And I did actually start this novel, and then I abandoned it because I thought, you know, this isn't going to work. Who is going to care about my view of space when there are real people who really have been into space and really do write about it already? So I put it aside and started writing other things, none of which I really got on with. And then I came back to this somewhat by accident. I opened the document again one day and something just clicked in me. And I thought, no, this really is the novel I want to write. And I just have to make it good enough that it justifies itself. But a lay person who's only looking at videos online could still have something to say about this beautiful subject matter, and inspiring, awesome subject matter. So that was it was a very kind of tentative start to the novel. I had to really persuade myself that it was something that I had permission to do, I suppose.
I think that's one of the things that I really found quite different about this novel. You say it's you didn't want to be didactic. And I don't think it's didactic at all. It's an observational novel. And in my introduction, I sort of perhaps added didacticisms to it that I felt in reading it, but I never felt that was your hand guiding it. You really did want to have a novel of observation, of grandeur and distance and just the wonder of seeing these things. It's a book about wonder, perhaps above all things. And it's clear that that wonder is yours, as you say, and perhaps has been for a long time. But I wonder if you thought at all, perhaps either worried or were excited by the fact that you would have to play with some genre expectations by going into space, and that readers of books that do inhabit space stations or rockets or things like that tend to be on the lookout for alien life, or for technical disasters that threaten the life on board the station. Although there is a quite nice crack that's emerging in the, and encounters with other unhappy spacecraft. But Orbital counters these expectations by living not in the space of speculative fiction, but of exacting realism of life in space. What the astronauts see and do is entirely plausible, and indeed it mirrors the experiences of those who have been aboard the International Space Station. What were the appeals and difficulties of having a setting that brings with it so much genre baggage?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. I mean, I don't go out of my way to subvert genre, but I'm also not terribly interested in the boundaries between genres. I mean, I think there's a conversation to be had there, but I think that writing is writing, and what I wanted to do was to write something that might count, I suppose, as nature writing about space, that tried to grapple with the idea of space as a reality and therefore as something that is open to realism, fictional realism. Because I find it really interesting that even now in the 21st century, when we've been several times to the moon, we've had humans in continual orbit around the Earth for 23 years now.
Oh, wow. Still,
yeah, and it's an incredible fact that every single day for the last 23 years, there have been humans orbiting the Earth. And yet, whenever we write about space or we watch films about space, they tend to be sci-fi. They tend to fictionalize and get into exactly the territory you were talking about there, aliens and sort of disaster and adversity. And in fact, there is this reality that's happening every single day of our occupation of space. And I wanted to write about that. I thought, why are we not writing about this? This is a terrain that humans have occupied for a long time. Realism, fictional realism, never explores it. And its reality and its realism is exactly what interested me about it, not its potential for sci-fi or for speculation or for disaster. And I think you're absolutely right in what you said about it being a book about wonder, because I wanted this to be a book precisely about wonder, about rapture, about beauty. And it takes place, the novel takes place over one day. So 16 sunrises, 16 sunsets, 16 orbits. And in that one day, nothing goes wrong. You know, it's just a day, a kind of mundane and extraordinary day orbiting the planet. That's precisely what I wanted to catch, you know, that contradiction, that dissonance between the sort of rather humdrum nature of our circling the planet every day in the ISS, and also the extraordinary fact of it, which is mind-blowing, really. And I wanted to try and hold those two things, that dissonance, on the page at once. And you're right, there is a nice crack appears on the space station. And actually, the space station in my novel isn't actually the ISS. I mean, I never call it that, but of course, that's what it is and that's what it's modeled on. And the ISS does have
Oh, it does.
Does. It's becoming somewhat dilapidated and it doesn't have that many years left in it. And, you know, of course, the war in Ukraine has hastened that difficulties of, you know, Russia and the West sharing that space. So it is on its last legs, and I find that a very interesting element to it, that it's both this incredibly expensive, mind-blowingly technical piece of kit that is also sort of retro and becoming quite rattly and vintage, and I love that. And I love that idea of this, what I've sort of called space pastoral, of something that's already fallen in slightly into nostalgia in the human, that it won't be around for long. And this era that we have now of orbiting the Earth is going to pass very quickly, and we're going to start going to the moon, back to the moon, and on to Mars, and this rather sort of tender orbit. I mean, I realize I'm romanticizing things here. Horrible.
No, I love that.
Oh, I am a novelist, so I'm an actor. But this, you know, this sort of attentive orbit of the ISS, where it's focused on the Earth, not beyond the Earth. I think that's an era of international collaboration and peace, which is passing, and that seemed also very interesting to me.
There is that tension between the members of your space station and this mission that's headed to the moon, and the sense among some of the astronauts that perhaps they're sort of inhabiting this lesser atmosphere, and that they should be proceeding on, and they think about what it would mean to proceed on to Mars, and yet at the same time, they're also struck by how unique their perspective is, and what it means to be so close to Earth. And I like that tension you established, and I wonder how that came about for you.
Yeah, well, I wanted to throw in a moon mission to the novel, because human species is planning to go back to the moon next year, in fact, I don't know, but to land humans on the moon again after 50 years of not having been there.
What country is doing that?
Well, it's mainly the US, so it's NASA.
Okay. Oh, I should know that. I didn't know we were sending a manned mission to moon.
Yeah, so there have been, it's called the Artemis mission, and there are three missions in total, and the third one will land humans on the moon. So the Artemis 2 just sort of sends them around the back of the moon. Artemis 3 lands them on the moon. They're going to be four astronauts in that mission. And so I wanted to nod to that fact that, as I said before, we are moving on in terms of space travel. We've had 30 or so years of not really, well, 50 years of not going to the moon. And we've had this time of peaceful cooperation in space. And that's really ending. I mean, the moon missions that are about to happen now were, I think, really catalyzed in Trump's presidency, because of this sort of nationalistic agenda to get the US back to the moon. And I think there's something that is, the space race has always been competitive. It's a race. It's always been. But there's something now that's very commercial, not very cooperative, very corporate. And it's about, I think, colonizing space, plundering
and going
it
after
Greece.
Those rare minerals that exist and couldn't be mined.
That's right, exactly. And I think a lot of people have really grave misgivings about that, because we've already sort of trashed the Earth. And now we are setting our sights on space, and we have trashed low Earth orbit. You know, it's full of space junk that we don't know what to do with. Although there is this kind of beautiful, optimistic urge to get beyond the Earth and to be sort of creatures who may one day be able to settle on another planet, so, a sadness to that, I think, because have we learned our lesson? What will we do to space? When we get there, how will we treat it? Will it be cooperative? It doesn't look like that. It looks like it's going to be competitive.
Yeah. I wonder if you might read a section for us from Orbital, Samantha, and so that we could get a sense of the way in which the novel looks differently at the planet and its atmospheric sensibilities. Would you be willing to do that?
Of course, yeah. So this part, I should say, is from the book is in 16 orbits, and this is orbit 15, which is entirely humanless. It's just one rolling description of an entire orbit around the Earth, and in fact, all the astronauts are fast asleep at this point. So it's only descriptive of the Earth. It's just gone 3 a.m. on the clocks up here. Down there, lightning pulses slow and dazzling from the black tens or hundreds of miles apart, and the satin dark turns milky with storm cloud. The equator nears. It brings a shrieking star, a huge Bethlehem light. It's not so much that they follow it as that it comes for them, a wave of dawn that washes night to the aft. And the clouds, the debris of a wrecked typhoon, are turbulent peaks of violet and peach, the hundred cymbal clang of sudden daylight. A few minutes later, they come in off the ocean where the Maldives, Sri Lanka, India are ripe with morning. The shallow shoals and sandbanks of the Gulf of Mannar, off to starboard are the shores of Malaysia and Indonesia, where the sand, algae, coral, and phytoplankton make the water luminous with a spectrum of greens. Except now there's tumbled, broken up storm cloud, and the usually tranquil view is weary and troubled. As they ascend India's east coast, the clouds are thinning. Morning strengthens. It's briefly stark, and then a haze moves in at the Bay of Bengal. The clouds wispy and numerous, and the Ganges silt estuary opens into Bangladesh. Umber plains and ochre rivers, burgundy valley of a 1,000-mile ridge. The Himalayas are Everest, an indiscernible blip. Everything beyond them, which caps the earth, is the rich, fresh brown of the Tibetan plateau, glacial, river-run, and studded with sapphire frozen lakes. Up now and diagonally across China's great mountains, the faint smudge of rust that is the extraordinary autumn bloom, Jujaigo Valley, and then the Gobi Desert in seeming plainness, except in looking closer, there are the fearless brushstrokes of seas in sand, the movement of water, and seas in brown bolts, duck egg, mauve, lemon, and crimson, and cast the arid in shades of oil spill, and makes of canyons nacreous shells, and on it presses the northward orbit into the afternoon of North Korea, and up above Hokkaido, Japan is a wisp trailing into a vanishing point. It was 11 orbits and 16 hours ago that they passed it going down, and this time they skim it going up, across the arm of Russian islands that sweep along the Pacific Ridge, over the Bering Sea. Now the land falls away like a silk. There is a feeling of climbing over the continents, climbing up and over the crest of the earth, up and over the North Pacific in a wide, clean arc. Though their orbit proceeds in a straight line around the planet's turn makes the orbital path appear to loop up and down, north and south, and keep on north and south in deep undulations, from the rim of the Arctic Circle to the southern seas. And now, at its northernmost point, it dips again. Far off to the left is a smooth, crisp bonbon of ice that marks Alaska, a cloud-free confection of crackable white. When the cloud accrues further south, the whole of the view is a liquid swirl of ice flow and cloud. The long tail of the Alaska Peninsula, a glimpse of land, of fjord and inlet, spine of mountain range. Ice flow thinning. The coast of Canada portside, not a coast at all, but a land that's been sledgehammered into random pieces. Before they came here, there used to be a sense of the other side of the world, far away and out of reach. Now they see how the continents run into each other like overgrown gardens, that Asia and Australasia are not separate at all, but are made continuous by the islands that trail between. Likewise, Russia and Alaska are nose to nose, barely a spit of water to hold them apart. Europe runs into Asia with not a note of fanfare. Continents and countries come one after the other, and the earth feels not small, but endlessly connected. An epic poem of flowing verses. It holds no possibility of opposition. And even when the oceans come and come and come and come in a seamless reel, and there's no sense of land or anything, and every country you've ever heard of seems to have slid into the cavern of space, even then, there's no waiting for anything else. There's nothing else, and never was. When land comes again, you think, oh yes, as if you've just woken up from a captivating dream. And when ocean comes again, you think, oh yes, as if you've woken up from a dream in a dream, until you're so dream-packed, you can find no way out. Don't think to try. You're just floating and spinning and flying 100 miles deep inside a dream. The night is over there, off to the east, where the horizon is blurring. Not here yet, but they're tracking closer. The Pacific below and falling away in a warped curve, snow-dusted peaks of the Sierra Nevada. And if you looked through a zoom lens, you'd see, far off, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego imprinted on a landmass, printed on sea, coastline drawn in sharp-tipped white, the greyish hue of singed shrubland, the fertile coastland, the fertile coastal plains of the Baja California, Central America's scrawny neck, then they too warp away.
That was lovely. Thank you so much, Samantha. So you have a sort of meta moment in which you describe an epic poem of flowing verses as a way to think about the earth. And that's certainly what this book is. And here they are spoken by a narrative voice that is not, it's not the characters. As you say, they're asleep. And I wonder what you think about or how you think of your narrative voice and how that narrative voice is connected to these characters and also this free-floating vision that allows us to see and understand the earth in verse rather than in national boundary.
All of my previous novels have been very much focused on a single character and have been entirely narrated by that character, whether first person or third person. I have located myself in that character's head neatly and dedicated myself to their consciousness. With this novel, I really wanted to do something different. And in fact, at first, I didn't really want there to be characters at all. although I recognize
that would have been that, fascinating.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you have to meet a novel halfway, don't you? So I thought I probably do need people in this novel. I mean, it needs a lens. It needs a place from which the earth is seen. The ISS is a kind of hideout in space that they can look from. So I quickly realized that I needed characters, but that I wanted my characters to be part of, almost to feel, yes, they are each a consciousness. And yes, they do look at the earth and we see things from their point of view. And we do learn a little bit about them as human beings, but I wanted them to be as much part of the scenery as the earth is. They are all sort of equal players in the, not more important, not less important. And tried to access a voice that felt much more kind of loose and imaginatively free and not tethered to the remit of what any one human being could feasibly think or feel, to try and break out of that, out of that habit of mine as a novelist, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed that project and it allowed me a panoramic view that I think absolutely necessary to write a novel like this. And of course, ultimately, you know, a lot of those views are my own, but I tried to come from a place in myself that was open and elusive and free and just sticking to my own view of things, to try and encompass multiple views, multiple perspectives, multiple lengths of time frames of shrinking and expanding time. So I think it the novel required that kind of project.
The members of the space station are American, Russian, Italian, British, and Japanese. They identify strongly with those nationalities and with the particularities of their cultures. If that weren't clear enough, they have divisions on the station, including, as I mentioned, that separate toilet and a crew area for the Russians. If we were to consider the points of tension in this meditative fiction, one would surely be the contradiction of the profound meaningfulness of national difference on the space station and the erasure of national boundaries outside the Earth's atmosphere. What was interesting about taking humans who had been raised to understand themselves in national terms and changing their context for understanding those boundaries?
Yeah, that's a very good question too. I think it is part of that dissonance, isn't it, that they are there to, not just there as a particular nationality, they're there to represent their entire country. And that's particularly true for the sort of the, say, the British astronauts. I mean, there's only ever been one British astronaut on the ISS. So he carried the whole kind of freight of national expectation with him. That's true for all the nationalities. I think that they are representing an entire nation when they go there. Yet, as you say, they're invited in their view of the Earth to dispense with any sense of not the relevance or the importance of nationality or the meaning of it, but the potential of it to divide, because they can't divide when they're there. I mean, in very real terms, all the different parts of the space station are entirely dependent on one another. You know, we even now, if Russia wanted to, or the US wanted to leave the ISS, they couldn't, because the Russian part is entirely dependent on the US part, and vice versa. So it's as a piece of machinery, it's an invitation to question the possibility, the true possibility of division between nations, while also recognizing that national identity, differences between nationalities, between cultures, matter. They exist, they matter, they're important, but they don't have to be divisive. And I think that the ISS sort of embodies that in a rather kind of beautiful way. Whether that was ever its intention, I don't know, but it does embody that. And I wanted the novel to try to grapple with that too.
The astronauts talk a lot about their what we would think of as their kind of nationalized experiences of culture. But there are these wonderful moments where there are concurrences, like when they're talking about a space they might be in other than the space station. And Chie refers to a kind of Japanese style house, and others concur that that might be just the best place to spend time. And I wonder how you decided upon what aspects of their national culture you would bring into these discussions, and how they would be meaningful both to the individual, but to the others who perhaps haven't shared that experience.
Well, I was thinking when I wrote, you know, those parts about in which they have discussions, usually at mealtimes, say, where they talk about, you know, the food that they've eaten at home, or TV programs, or whether the ISS should be sort of refurbished as a Japanese farmhouse. I was thinking about when I lived in Japan for a couple of years way back, and I was with lots of different nationalities there, teaching English, and a lot of our conversations would gravitate towards exactly those things. So we would talk about TV programs that we watched as children, or the sweets, the candies that we had when we were growing up. And it was those sorts of really small details about our individual past that we brought to bear. And that was where we could flag up differences, but also similarities. We'd find out that we'd all watch the same thing. So I don't know what the astronauts talk about on the ISS, but they surely can't always talk about ammonia leaks and brown, you know, in replacing the water filter. I think that there's probably a lot of really mundane and detailed and the small stuff of life that makes us tick as human beings are things that we carry with us. And I wanted to have them talk about whether it's realistic or not. I don't know, but that's, I was just recalling my days of living overseas and what we talked about a lot.
I lived in Japan as well, and I recall those very, very conversations, often about like breakfast foods and television shows and things of the like. I'm very interested in the fact that the Velázquez painting Las Meninas plays an unexpected role in Orbital. Sean, the American astronaut, brings a postcard of the painting that was given to him by his wife, who wondered about the perspective in the painting, who's central on the canvas and who is the viewer. Point of view and centrality of viewer takes on different meaning in the space station, where the astronaut's view of the Earth from a godlike view the Earth from a godlike perspective, as though they are the painters of the planet's features. How does the painting draw out the question of perspective and the power of a distant view of human existence?
Yeah, I first encountered that painting when I was at university, actually, and I did philosophy at university, and one of our lectures was about this painting and about the way it had exploded the sense of perspective and what was possible with a painting. And I loved it from that moment. I love it still. And I found myself writing about it in this novel. And then I thought, what am I doing? This doesn't belong in the novel at all. This is just self-indulgent, and I'm going to cut it. So I cut it. And then the more the novel went on, the more I thought, no, I really want it there, because it does say something about this shuffling of perspective. Who's looking at who? Who's the subject? Who's the object? The whole kind of shattering of perspective that happens when we're in space. So it seems a really kind of neat way of expressing some of those things. And also something, and this is in the book, that's not a spoiler in any way to talk about it. Something that's always interested me about that painting is that people talk about it in great detail, and you'll find sort of numbered all the people in the painting are numbered, and it'll analyze what each person is doing in the painting and who is looking at who and so on. And there's this big, beautiful dog at the foreground of the painting, and nobody ever acknowledges it, as if it's just kind of, you know, a coincidence that Velázquez put it there. And I think that's really interesting, that one creature in the painting that isn't being looked at and isn't looking at anything or anybody, including you, the viewer, is this very handsome dog right at the foreground. And it's sort of, I mean, I didn't really go into this in the novel, but it speaks to something that I'm quite interested in, which is that I think one of humanity's problems is that we have stopped seeing ourselves as animals, not just that we have stopped really seeing animals, but we've stopped counting ourselves among animals.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't appreciate ourselves as animals, as part of the animal kingdom, and therefore our responsibilities towards other animals, and also, you know, our own impulses as animals, which we find quite difficult to override. So that one painting seemed to contain a whole raft of pondering for me that I wanted to put in the novel, but largely as that way of expressing perspective, subject, object, the way that it's all reversed and shattered.
I've always, ever since I was lucky enough to see the painting in the Prado, I've always thought of the dog as the punctum of the painting, and I can't stop. Mm-hmm. You know, my perspective always goes to the dog, and so I find it interesting that people have ignored it as though he's like a seti or something.
Exactly. How it is, yeah. He never gets, or she never gets counted as a subject in the painting, and I find that in itself really interesting.
Oh yeah,
it's just another piece of furniture. Yeah.
One of the questions that emerged from the novel for me was the cost of human progress, or what you call the politics of want, and what it means for astronauts to have a distance from that. That's something that we find almost impossible living on terra firma. The politics, as you say, of growing and getting a billion extrapolations of the urge for more, that's what they begin to see when they look down. And you go on to say that the astronauts, more than anyone else, understand the cost, quote, on their rocket, whose boosters at liftoff burn the fuel of a million cars. It's a great irony that these people whose rocket added so much CO2 to the atmosphere have the greatest vantage on the destruction of the planet in the name of progress. And I wonder, we've been talking a lot about contradictions, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that marvelous contradiction.
It does seem to be the central contradiction, doesn't it, of progress, I guess. I mean, you know, if the world, if the sort of evolution, progress of the world were left to me, we would still all be living in caves, and we would be occasionally and with great difficulty killing the odd rabbit here and there and then feeling very guilty about it. You know, we have not got anywhere. So I appreciate that I have a very, in a sense, very unadventurous, very unambitious view on human progress. I kind of would like us all just to stop progressing for a while. And I understand that every good thing that has come from humanity into humanity has come as a result of people who are not like me, who are adventurous and ambitious and want to see around the next corner and want to take risks and want to sacrifice something for the sake of getting somewhere else or something else. And I think that that's the kind of central pull at the sort of heart of the human question of what should we do? How should we act? Should we go into space and prepare ourselves to be a multi-planetary species, as Elon Musk would like? Or should we just try and tidy up this planet first and settle our affairs here before we move somewhere else? What price does progress come with? You know, we look at this question all the time, and none of these questions I'm raising are revelatory on you, but I think it's the pull that's at the heart of everything, and that space exploration seems really to be constantly trying to reconcile itself to this question, because space travel, as you say, is incredibly polluting. And should we be ransacking the moon and Mars in the way that we have the Earth? Should we be doing that? Maybe we should. I mean, maybe it's just in our nature. Maybe this is absolutely to do with our animal nature as a creature that wants to colonize, wants to claim territory. I don't think it's something we'll ever resolve. And in any case, we will go to the moon and we will go to Mars. These things will happen. But I think there is this huge pull at the center of it, which is the sort of source of all of our difficulty around what progress should look like and who it should benefit. And I don't think we'll ever, never resolve these questions.
When I talk to colleagues of mine in environmental science, they emphasize that if the planet is to be saved, at least saved from the point of view of human habitability, that there needs to be a massive reordering of a sense of what counts as progress. Not necessarily quite to the extreme that your imagination might take us, but that it reorienting what it means to progress and to go away from extractability and colonizing and things like that. And, you know, the consequences are so visible already to us, and yet you have them visible in a different way, as NASA asks that the astronauts keep their eye on that super typhoon that's moving across the planet and gaining size and speed and destructive power. And it's a clear stand-in in the novel for the larger dangers of climate change. It feels perilous and unstoppable. Mm-hmm. But I still feel like this is a hopeful novel. And I came away feeling very hopeful. And I wonder if you feel that same hopefulness, if you're right that we're not going to give up progress in that sense. Is there hopefulness to be found? Do you see the typhoon as in a way a microcosm for the damage of that vision of progress?
I don't know if it's a hopeful novel. It's interesting because this question comes up quite often. Some people read it as quite a pessimistic novel, and some people like you as a fairly optimistic one. And I wanted to try again to hold both of those positions in sort of a tension, you know, a state of suspension and tension, without being evasive or vague. I wanted to hold the possibility of both things at once. That there is a lot of evidence to suggest that we're probably doomed. There's also a lot of evidence to suggest that we have ways out of this. that we can do better, that we can do things differently. We have means, we have the information, we have the brilliant minds, we have people who care, lots of people who care. And I feel daily this this ambivalence about the question of whether to be hopeful, as I think a lot of people do. And I wanted to just hold it all, to suspend the question, to leave it hanging there. Because, I mean, you know, in the novel, there are some passages in which I kind of extrapolate away from the here and now and start talking about it from a more cosmic view. And I think that hope is maybe a matter of our perspective. And the Earth, you know, won't last forever. We won't last forever. We will just be a kind of momentary blinking light in the sort of great history of the Milky Way, of the universe. We're nothing, and we know that. Whether we can have hope is a matter of how far out you want to zoom. I mean, you know, if you can't find what's in front of you hopeful, just zoom out a bit further, and there'll be something there that's hopeful, or that's sort of generative or interesting or exciting. And I wanted to use that device in the novel, that instead of trying to say we're all doomed or there's great hope, to say, let's just zoom in a bit. Let's just zoom out a little bit. What does it look like from here? We look at it from this distance. How does it look? How does it sound? To try using that very kind of beautiful elastic form of the novel to zoom in and out and just see what things look like from different distances and timescales. And in that way, try to hold this question of optimism or pessimism in balance, in suspension all the time. And I don't mind whether it's read as a pessimistic novel or an optimistic one. I think the question is out there. It's unanswered.
Well, lest we end with thoughts of possible doom, I'd love to know a little bit about what you're reading these days and whether you have any recommendations you might have for our listeners.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about quite recent books for this, because I reel off lots of marvelous things that I love and have always loved, but I was thinking about things I've read in the last year or so. There is a novel called Kairos by Jenny Erpenbeck, the German writer, which is a love story set in Germany when the Berlin Wall still existed. And it's very sort of quiet, beautiful, but sort of quietly devastating story. I really loved it. I love her work. I don't know that Kairos is her best, but I love the way she writes. I love her concerns. So that would be one of my recommendations.
I'm always drawn to stories of the age of the wall, for whatever reason. I find them fascinating.
Me too. It is such a rich territory. And I love in Kairos the way she depicts life in the East as rich, allowing people to thrive, as culturally diverse and rich. And it's not a blinkered view, but it was a view that we don't see very often. We have this idea of it as being bleak, grey, dismal, everything is suppressed. And it was a much more, partly because it's a love story and things are kind of expanding in it. It feels like a much more kind of open and hopeful vision, but not naive, but, you know, just showed a different aspect to life in the East. So that was a really thought-provoking, beautiful novel. There is a novel that came out, it was last year or the year before, by Alan Rossi, called Our Last Year. I don't know whether you've come across it, but it's...
I haven't.
It's really wonderful, and it's a portrait of a marriage that is sort of on the rocks. And it's so beautifully observed. It's psychologically very interesting, and seeing both the man and the woman's point of view and the unraveling of this relationship and the ways which they try to save and do save it. And then, you know, it's really sort of gentle, but also a really good, quite penetrating account of what happens when a relationship begins to break down. I thought it's really wonderful. And the other novel is one that hasn't come out yet. I think it comes out this March, and it's by a British novelist. And in fact, she was one of my students.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah. And now and again, you know, this happens. One of your students just writes an absolutely pelting novel. And it's called How to Be Somebody Else. And it's by an author called Miranda Pountney. And it's set in New York, actually. And she's a British novelist, but the novel is set in New York. And it's I worried when I picked it up that it would fall into that terrain of sad girl novels.
Is it set in Brooklyn? And that's all I need to know.
No, it's mainly on Manhattan, I think.
Oh, okay. Well, then it's always the genre.
Yeah. I don't really take that well to that genre, but subverts it a little bit and does something different. And it's just so wonderfully written. It's so wonderful. And I think it deserves to do really well. I hope it will. I am unfashionably, I'm a great fan of John Updike. And it did remind me of, her writing does remind me of Updike's writing, actually. And I did a blurb for the book, and in the blurb I mentioned Updike, and my editor took his name out of the blurb. It only is that problematic these days? But I love him, and I couldn't give higher praise than to liken writing to his. So I think it's a really exciting, brilliant new novel, and I think it's out.
Well, John Updike was the very first author I ever heard read from his work at Haverford College sometime in the 1980s, and I don't know his story of decline in the cultural zeitgeist, but I will forever love his language. So this makes me want to find How to Be Somebody Else and enjoy it for that very reason.
Yeah, and I'm very envious that you heard him read. I would have loved that.
Well, the thing that I most want my listeners to do is run out to your independent bookstore and buy a copy of Orbital by Samantha Harvey. Truly one of the best things you'll read all year. And Samantha, it's been an absolute pleasure to get to talk to you about this beautiful novel.
Likewise, Chris. Thank you so much for your brilliant questions.
Well, that's all from me for now. My thanks to the brilliant Samantha Harvey for coming on the show to talk about her fifth novel, Orbital, which I would put money on to win one of the major novel prizes this year. You can find links to purchase Orbital and all of Samantha's recommended books at the website, burnedbybooks.com. There you'll find all of our previous episodes, links to buy a podcast t-shirt, and ways to get in contact. As you listen, take a moment to rate the show on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Until next time, this has been Burned by Books.